In the Moment on SDPB is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 20th through 22nd in Brookings.
Mosquitoes. So many mosquitoes. From SDPB, today is Thursday, July 11th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we check in with an epidemiologist for an update on West Nile virus. Are the clouds of mosquitoes putting our health at risk? Then, singer-songwriter Eliza Blue joins us in the studio. We'll talk about her latest book. It's called Little Pasture on the Prairie. It includes a decade of stories from a western South Dakota ranch. Plus, SDPB's Summer with the Symphony. We hear Haydn's Symphony No. 59 in A major. The Fire Symphony is later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The wet summer weather has led to an influx in mosquitoes across South Dakota with the potential to carry and spread West Nile virus. We're checking in on tracking conditions and prevention efforts. Anita Baradwaja is a vector-borne epidemiologist with the South Dakota Department of Health, and she is with us on the phone now. Anita, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's happy to be back.
It's impossible not to think about West Nile virus right now because there are literal clouds of mosquitoes, but not all of them carry the disease. So let's just start at the beginning with what exactly West Nile virus is.
Yeah, as many of you may know, West Nile virus is a mosquito-borne infection transmitted to humans through the bite of an infected mosquito. In South Dakota, the primary vector of West mosquito is Culex tarsalis that transmit West Nile virus to humans. Last year, we had about 98 human cases reported and 4 West Nile related deaths reported in the state. And for this year, we have had 1 human case reported from Beadle County and a couple of mosquito being tested positive with West Nile virus in Brookin County.
All right. So normally, what are we looking at for seasons? And then I'm wondering if the rain, East River and Southeast South Dakota particularly, is going to make the season worse. So first, is there a peak season?
Yeah. For West Nile virus in South Dakota, the highest number of cases have been reported in the month of August, followed by September and July. So we are well into West Nile season. And the peak for West Nile cases in the state from July to August can be attributed to several, you know, interrelated factors. I'll go a little bit in depth for that. So first, we're looking into mosquito cycle. That plays a significant role, you know, mosquito population, particularly the primary vector of West Nile virus. Culex tarsalis reach their highest number during the warm summer months. And the summer rains and flood create temporary breeding habitats such as paddles, stagnant water bodies. That could also increase the mosquito population. And then warmer temperature also play a role, not only supporting the mosquito breeding and also create the development of virus within the mosquitoes that kind of enhance the likelihood of transmission to humans. And also human behavior, we cannot forget that, also contribute to the seasonal peak in West Nile cases. You know, during warmer months, we all like to go out and do activities, hiking, camping, things like that. That could also attribute the exposure to mosquito bites.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk a little bit about the different kinds of mosquitoes. Does every kind of mosquito have the potential for transferring West Nile virus?
Not really. I'll just start off with this year, and then I'll provide a historical data a little bit. So based on the mosquito surveillance across the state this year, we are mainly seeing Aedes vexans, which are what we call floodwater mosquitoes. While this Aedes vexans doesn't typically carry West Nile virus, another species. You just heard about Culex tracellus, which can pose a significant risk of West Nile. But if we go back and look into the 4 to 5 years mosquito trapping efforts across the South Dakota data, we have approximately about 20 mosquito species in the state. But the good news is Aedes vexin is the dominant species, but we don't have very heavy risk of West Nile virus on that species. So what we are actually looking into and be very careful about is the Culex tracellus bite.
Okay. Tell me again, how many species do we have in South Dakota of mosquitoes?
About 20 species.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about what we should do and what we should not do, especially if we're immune compromised. Let's start there.
Yeah, sure. This is my favorite part. So there are several protective measures that individuals can take to minimize their risk of mosquito bites, like right after rainfalls and, you know, flood events. The first thing I would recommend you to do is, like, remove the standing water that creates a perfect breeding ground for mosquitoes. So first, go around the property and look if you find any bird baths, buckets, or other old tires, any containers that can hold water. Because mosquitoes lay eggs in still water and can go from egg to a biting adult in just 5 days. So this is why it's very important that you check regularly for standing water around house and to dump out any water that we find. And the second thing I would recommend is folks to use insect repellent containing DEET when venturing outdoors activities. And additionally, wearing protective gear like, you know, long sleeve shirts, long pants provide extra defense against mosquito bites. So if you can do that, using mosquito repellent, I want to highlight, is very important for several reasons. One is to prevent West Nile virus by keeping away from the mosquito bite. And for comfort, again, you know, though Aedes vexin is a nuisance, but it can be annoying. It is itchy and very uncomfortable. So repellent can help prevent bites and allowing for more like enjoyable outdoor experiences. And if you can, limit outdoor activities from dusk to midnight when mosquitoes are most active.
Yeah, we're having a little trouble getting that bug spray right now in the city of Sioux Falls. It's possible some people are stockpiling it. I'm not shouting any accusations, however. There are a lot of empty shelves right now. If you can't find that, though, you do have some other options, like you mentioned there. What is the Department of Health do to control? I mean, the dashboard, you can check the dashboard. What are some of the things that maybe the public doesn't see that the Department of Health does to prevent or, you know, provide further information on West Nile?
Sure. We have a dashboard that we update on daily basis throughout the mosquito season. The goal is to provide timely information on the number of cases reported and detection of mosquito pools in the state. So this allows individuals to monitor, you know, where transmission is occurring in the state and take necessary safety precautions, as I just listed, to provide West Nile infection. Other than that, the state has also allocated about $500,000 in grant funds for cities, counties, and tribes to help control mosquito population and prevent the spread of West Nile in the local community. So nearly 200 applicants were awarded this year. The funding is totally based on the population and history of West Nile in the community. And the list of the awardees and the amount awarded is available on the DOH website to check out.
All right. One more thing, which is, what symptoms should you be worried about and should you talk to your doctor about? How do you know if you have this and maybe need some supportive treatment?
Sure. So I'll start off with the incubation period, because usually symptoms occur 3 to 14 days after being bitten by an infected mosquito. So if you do develop symptoms after, you know, you monitor the mosquito bite, do watch out for these symptoms like fever, body ache, chills, joint pains. And in some cases, about 1 in 150 people who get sick with West Nile will lead to severe illnesses like encephalitis or meningitis, you know, which are inflammation of the brain and surrounding tissue. So symptoms for neurologic infection you should watch out is high fever, headache, stiff neck, stupor, disorientation, and it could lead to paralysis.
Mm. All right. Take it seriously. Anita Barwaja, thank you so much. It's always a delight to have you on. I know you have to repeat the information many times, so we thank you for doing that public service.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. You might know Eliza Blue as host of SDPB's Wish You Were Here, as the author of the book The Accidental Rancher, as a local folk musician, or through her weekly newspaper column Little Pasture on the Prairie and its companion podcast. But if you have never read the column or visited Eliza Blue's Western South Dakota ranch, through her words or in person, because you had a party recently,
you are
in luck, because there's a new book where 10 years of curated essays are available from the South Dakota Historical Society Press, A Decade of Tales from a Western South Dakota Ranch by Eliza Blue, a nice foreword by Christopher von Dracek, our mutual friend. Eliza, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Isn't it so nice to hold it in your hand?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, there's something about, I don't know, that actually getting to hold a book that feels that makes it real.
Yeah.
So, you know, we knew it was going to happen, but until you really get it.
The first Little Pasture on the Prairie, we have to go back a ways and maybe ground our conversation in how you came here and how you were overwhelmed, as many people before who have gone out west, by the landscape, by your life in it, by loneliness, by beauty, and you decided to write about it. Take us back to that time for people who aren't familiar with your work.
Well, so I didn't start out in South Dakota. I actually was born in a suburb of Detroit, and my family lived there till I was 13. Then we moved to Minneapolis. I went to college on the East Coast, traveled around, became a musician, kind of was on tour for years. And then I hit this wall of burnout where I just was like, something's going to have to shift. I was in my, I think I was 33, and I just knew I needed a change. So I came to Western South Dakota not intending to stay long. Mm-hmm. And I always joke that first I fell in love with sheep and then I fell in love with a cowboy, which is a little paradoxical, actually. But we've made it work. We're going to be married 10 years here in this coming autumn. So, I took in these two bum lambs from a neighbor, because I just thought it would be a cool experience to have. And I fell so in love with them. And then I got some little chicks. And I just knew, well, now I can't move anywhere. You can't keep sheep. Because I just loved it too much.
Yeah.
I loved the open spaces. But I also love the rhythm of chores, the rhythm of seasons that are part of working in agriculture. And so when I first started writing about it, it was actually because, I mean, everything was new, so it was exciting, and I had a lot of things I wanted to share that I was experiencing, and I think I just had all these stories I wanted to tell. I didn't really think that people would take notice of it. It was more a creative outlet for me. And again, as I was transitioning from, you know, when I was on the road, I was playing music, like, you know, 5 nights a week,
yeah.
And then suddenly I didn't have an opportunity for those creative juices to be shared. That was how the column itself started. And it was really amazing that those stories, I think, just resonated with people. So it kind of took on a life of its own, which was exciting. And now, 10 years down the road, my experience, you know, I'm no longer a newcomer in the way that I was.
Yeah.
But now it has become sort of a weekly practice, because I still write the column. It has become this sort of weekly check-in, because I think it is easy when you live in a place to sort of become a little, just not to notice the beauty, not to,
sure,
like step into that place of wonder that you have when everything is fresh and new. So it's really been cool to have to cultivate that practice of like going back to like noticing, really,
yeah,
noticing those details. So it's been a real gift for me, and that evolution has been cool to experience. And then to go back for this book and go through 10 years worth of columns to pick out what the columns we were going to use, that was a pretty cool thing to do too. I joked that it was like, I said, this is the easiest book I'm ever going to write because it was already written, but it was also pretty hard because it took me 10 years.
But as you started going back and looking, especially when you look at things sequentially, were there things that you noticed that surprised you?
Yeah. One of the things that surprised me is that, like, epiphanies that I think I'm having that are new, I've actually been having all along.
Yep.
So I was, like, surprised by how wise I was when I just some of the things I wrote early on, I was impressed by the wisdom I had then. And it really just made me think how our sort of development as an individual is more of a spiral. It isn't like, you know, from point A to point B. It's like, and again, this is where I think seasonal living is really cool too, because you can go back and it's like every spring I was writing these variations on this, like, the joy of the beginning of spring, and every fall, you know, the bittersweet of letting go of this, the warmth and passing into the long cold, and that hasn't really changed, because that just keeps being true. It keeps being wonderful every spring, and it keeps being a little bit like, all right, brace ourselves for winter.
Have you gone back to look at other, I know the answer is yes, you have, but tell me some of the authors that you have gone back and used as touchstones, their work, the Dan O'Briens, the Linda Hazelstroms, the people who have reported on their lives and have done so over a period of time where we get to watch them develop as well, but yet return to some of these really important themes. Who has inspired you?
Well, Kathleen Norris definitely was my first, and I'd probably say still biggest inspiration, because I read Dakota, I don't know, within maybe a month or two of coming to Western South Dakota. So that was like my introduction to the landscape was almost at the same time as my introduction to her work. And then I revisited it over the years. So that's also been cool to see how, as my understanding of the place has evolved, my understanding of her work has evolved. And that particular work, because she lived in Lemon, South Dakota, which is very close to where I live in Bison. So a lot of the things she describes, you know, as I came to know them more intimately, that changed my perspective on her writing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also funny. Somebody gave me a book of Laura Ingalls Wilder, and I kind of knew that she had written a newspaper column. And now I'm blanking on the name, but it was something like The Farmer's Wife or something like that.
Okay.
And I didn't realize that she had written a column, or I guess I knew, but I didn't know exactly the topic. So someone gave me a book that was a compilation. And that was also really interesting to see sort of the trajectory of her writing, from writing something that was very meant to be for a local audience, meant to be, you know, again, just a weekly thing, something you picked up and put down, and then how that eventually evolved into, you know, the Little House on the Prairie books.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of cool to see that as well.
Little Pasture on the Prairie was on In the Moment early on. Do you remember?
Yeah, I do.
Send us things, and then we would play your essays that you would read and lay music underneath them. And
Well, this is, and again, with a column versus a book length thing, I mean, it's just such a different endeavor. And those first, I think we called it Postcards from the Prairie, because it was just
right.
This little snapshot.
Postcards from the Prairie, yeah.
And that, again, has been, I don't know, we're in an interesting time culturally where, you know, supposedly our attention spans are getting shorter and shorter, which I think is probably true. And maybe, I don't know, bad or good, it is what it is. So taking something like the essays in this book, I mean, I get 650 words, and that's what most of the newspapers I work for, that's what they want.
Yeah.
So to try and get an idea fleshed out that quickly is hard. And it's funny, at the beginning of the book, the essays are longer because my first editor, she didn't give me a a word limit. So they're pretty rambly.
You have lots of other things I want to talk about musically with some other projects that you're doing aside from this book, but you have your guitar, and maybe we'll take a pause from our talking, and you can play something for us. Set us up. What would you like to play first?
Well, this is a song. It's called Living Like a River, and I've been sort of on tour the past couple weeks, and I have been joking when I play this song that it's the prequel to The Little Pasture on the Prairie, because it definitely, before I came here, I moved a lot. I was on the road all the time. I didn't know if I was ever going to find a home that felt like home, but I wanted to. So that's what this song is about.
Mm-hmm. We can listen to the whispers in the trees from my little bed beside the grassy sea. And you can tell me in a voice so soft and low that you will always love me and you'll never let me go. But the truth is, I fear love can never win. And even as I say it, I'm diving in. Yeah, even as I say it, I'm diving in. See, I fear I'll hurt you in ways that I can never mend. I write you letters that I don't plan to send. And even as I sing this in a voice so soft and low, I'm turning to a place you cannot go. There lays a bed of stone. Beneath the desert, cool rivers often flow. I believe it like a river, but I'd rather be a tree with roots that reach the deep. I never have to leave.
That worked. Awesome. Thanks. Oh, Eliza Blue playing live in our studio here. That reminds me of, I wish I could find it. Maybe if someone from the Historical Society is listening, they can point me to what volume. But there's a volume of South Dakota History Journal where some women writers analyzed the work of women who had written east of the river in South Dakota and west of the river. And with the concept of rootedness.
I would love to.
In there versus, kind of a wandering or a wanderlust kind of. It was a beautiful piece that it's one of my favorite things that I've ever read in South Dakota History Journal. So
I
have to find the right one.
Oh, yeah. All right. We got to find that. That sounds amazing.
So as we talk about things that intersect and ideas that end up interwoven with others, tell us a little bit about The Grass Widow and this folk opera with our friend John Bakken.
Well, any excuse to do anything with John Bakken is like well worth it. But so when I first sort of had decided I was staying in Western South Dakota, and there was still a lot of tumult because I wasn't sure kind of what was going to become of me. And the summer where I started working on The Grass Widow, it started out just as a series of poems, and it was just the most probably creative period of my life so far, maybe it will turn out to be the most creative of my life, because it was just intense. It was like every day I was like, these poems are coming, and I'm not even a poet. I mean, I would never claim to be a poet, but I would sit down, I would go out and do my chores, and then I would sit down and I'd just write and write. So at the end of this summer, I was teaching high school then. I went back to school, and I had this just pile of poems that I didn't know what to do with. Well, over the years, some of them started to evolve into songs. And in fact, my last album, South Dakota First of May, there were several songs on that that had started out as poems in this series. But then I just kept getting called back to it. And I started to see, you know, once having a little distance from it, when I'd first been writing them, they were semi-autobiographical. But the more distance I had from it, the more I started to realize that it was its own story. You know, I could understand it because I'd lived parts of it, but really it was something outside of me. So the title, The Grass Widow, comes from a euphemism that apparently was common, I think maybe 100 years ago, and that implied a woman who had been abandoned by her husband, but like not officially abandoned. So often it was like he had just gone to like work somewhere else and then never came back. Mm. And maybe he died, nobody knew, or maybe he had just left her. It also could sometimes be used if it was more of a common law situation where they weren't officially married, so she wasn't even officially widowed. So a little bit of a fallen woman, but more or a woman abandoned, certainly. So the character of the grass widow, her husband goes, he's going to go sell wheat at the, you know, nearest town. And we haven't like picked an exact date, but presumably it's back in time quite a bit. And she's out on the plains and he goes and he's going to go sell their harvest and then come back and they're going to try to winter together, make it through the winter. Well, he doesn't come back. So it's about her surviving through the winter. And when she comes to the spring, she realizes that the love, you know, at the beginning she's pining for him, but by the end she realizes that the true love story of her life is actually with the land itself, with the plants, with the animals that she's come into relationship with and that really save her life, because she is, by living off the land, she's able to make it through the winter. Mm-hmm. So that relationship is reciprocal. So that's the story arc. And we've got all the songs written. John and I have been working together. So we're hoping, really hoping, in the summer of 2025, we'll be able to get some other actors and musicians together and be able to kind of take the show on the road. So that's the goal. Yeah.
You have a little bit, we've got about 3 minutes left. So if I start waving at you, that means we're going to wrap. Right. And you'll just fade out and I'll talk over you. This beautiful radio moment. Yeah. But a little excerpt from Grass Widow.
So this is the overture. This is the very first song when he's packing up and getting ready to leave, and she's watching him go, and she's working on a loom in their front yard. And he says, by the time you're done with that, with the tapestry you're working on, I'll be back. So she sings, and of course she gets to the end of the song, and the tapestry is done, and he has not returned.
Against the hard loom of your love, I scuttle back and forth, 'cause you're leaving. Weaving fast with twine and leather to tie this whole thing back together. Autumn branches tired of dancing, gray and twisted. Hold me. I search the field, find only tatters. The meadowlark's flown and left her feathers. The day is breaking. The weather's changing. The robins fled and left me waiting. Hold me closer. Hold me closer. Autumn branches tired of dancing, gray and twisted, oh me. Against the hard loom of your love, I scuttle back and forth, 'cause you're leaving.
Well done, my friend Eliza Blue. The new book is called Little Pasture on the Prairie. It's from the South Dakota Historical Society Press. Another great book from their list, by the way. Come on often. It's nice to see you, friend.
All right, thank you.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We close the hour with our signature Summer with the Symphony. Today, Joseph Haydn's Fire Symphony, that's Symphony number 59 in A major. The composer was free, because of the support of a royal patron, to experiment with his music, and importantly, to try things out on an audience and see what engaged, pleased, or challenged them. Haydn would not have called this the Fire Symphony, though much about the order in which his music was composed and performed has been lost to history. Excerpts were most likely attached to the theater of the time, which may help explain how it got that name. Here is the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra under the direction of Maestro Delta David Geyer. This performance was recorded in January in the Washington Pavilion in Sioux Falls.
Thank you.
That is Summer with the Symphony featuring the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you on tomorrow's In the Moment. SDPB's Kara Hetland goes back underground for Neutrino Day 2024. In the Moment broadcasts live from the Sanford Underground Research Facility in Lead. Science and fun collide as we seek to answer the most fundamental questions of the universe. That's coming up on Fridays In the Moment from all of us at SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.